David Stanley. Welcome to Totally Unrelated.
Yeah, thanks.
We're here at the Dayton Funny Bone where I don't say my dreams started here, but this is where I think I met you for the first time.
I think so, yeah. Probably a clash.
A clash. Might have even been, we may not have been competing against each other, but definitely, like, so when I first came on the scene, the clash was the thing for local comics. It was like they would be sold out.
Yeah.
You know, like to get into the clash, like to have enough people to show up so that you could actually perform.
So what'd they do? Limited to 10 at one
Yeah, day. It was 10, and whoever brought the most people to the show got on the show. So there could be, I remember the first time I was here watching somebody else, I think it was Laura Feld, and I was supporting her, and I was one of her people.
You were in lofty aspirations with her, was that?
Yeah, I think, to be honest, I don't know if that had started yet or had been defined yet, but I guess it would have had to have been because I don't think I was like friends with her. That's how I met her, was through Karen and Lofty, and so we were doing improv and stuff like that. And I think at this point I'd maybe been on stage 2 or 3 times. I wasn't sure I was doing this yet, but I was very excited about it. And I came and I was watching these people, and they were like walking through the lobby, and they're out on the patio, and they're looking over their notes. Mm-hmm. And they're like basically like quizzing themselves, almost like people getting ready for a big test or something.
Right.
And then
last minute cramming.
Exactly. And then they come out and they announce who's going to be on the show. And the people that I saw that were like the most bunged up about like their material didn't even get on the show. And that's when I was like, oh, this is exclusive. You know, like this is something to really covet. And then the show started and it was kind of hit or miss. Out of the 10 comics, 5 were really good, and 5 was almost like their first time.
Well, they always had that thing. It's like, well, if you don't like what you just saw wait 5 minutes and someone else will be here. You know,
exactly.
And that's exactly how those shows went.
It was, and it was when somebody did well, it was amazing. Mm-hmm. But when somebody didn't do well, they had no problem giving them nothing but silence.
Right.
And that's what I've always found interesting about those shows. So, I say that to say this. The other night, you may have seen we had a situation here.
Yeah, I saw that on Facebook.
Where I had produced the show. And by produce, I just mean, like, Megan was like, hey, instead of me using the regular people I always use, do you have anybody that you think would be able to go on the show and never been here before? And he found an MC and a headliner who had never been here before but definitely should be. Mm-hmm. And then the feature act was a holdover from the weekend, which is like a contract thing, right? So I knew that was going to be a thing. So I wasn't even on the show. I don't know if I would have had more wherewithal if I knew I was going to be on the show to like grill every single person. But the way it happened was I was sitting with the headliner and the MC out here in the showroom before the show started, and then the headliner had just shown up and he was like, well, show me where the green room is. So we go back in the green room. That's where the feature act was sitting, and I hadn't met him yet.
Okay.
So I introduced myself to him, and then out of the bathroom comes this other kid.
And the green room bathroom.
Okay. And so I was like, oh, so I assumed he was with the feature act.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was like, yeah, I've seen you before. I saw you in Columbus one time. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. And I was like, was it with Titus? And he was like, I don't remember who it was with. And I was like, if it was with Titus, you would have remembered.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because you weren't going there to see a regular show. You were going
you
to,
were
see
to see
Christopher
Titus. Yeah.
So I was kind of like, I thought that was kind of strange. Like, clearly, it wasn't Titus then. And I was like, okay. And so then I leave. I don't remember why, but I come back in and I'm like, okay, so here's the times. I think that's what I was doing, was going over it with Megan. I was like, all right, Jason, you're going to do 10 to 15. There's no obligation. If it's going well, stretch it. If it's not, don't. I was like, and then Aaron, you're going to middle. And then Jason, who's the MC, says, oh, and this guy's going to do a guest set, I think, right? And he's like, yeah, I'm going to. And I was like, all right, you'll go right after Jason. He was like, so I'll be after the first guy. And I was like, yeah. And he was like, okay. And then, you know, I was like, and we want the show to end around 9:15. You know, we'll let you know once the checks are dropped. And he's like, cool. So we go out, Jason goes up, and I could kind of tell that this guy was like, he was like, now after my set, do I have to stay in the green room? And I was like, you don't have to be in here now.
Right.
You know, like the show's about to start. You may as well go sit out there and wait for him to start. You can go sit with your friends if you want. Just know that when he's wrapping up, you're going to go up on stage. And he was kind of like, like he was talking to me like I didn't know what I was talking about the whole time. And that's what I thought, like, okay, well, clearly this guy's got permission from somebody above me. So then...
Didn't even really question it.
I didn't even question it, because why would you be in the green room, using the green room bathroom, if you didn't know something? You know, if somebody hadn't okayed you to be there. And then so he goes up after Jason, who did very well for an MC on a Sunday night for 50 people. You know, that can be kind of a tough spot. This guy goes up, and from the minute he gets on stage, he sets his notes down on the stool, pulls the stool all the way to the front, takes the mic out of the stand, and then just moves the mic to the side a little bit, not behind him at all or anything like that. I was like, this is going to be bad. A good solid 35 seconds of silence from the time he was introduced to, you know, like from the time he took the stage to when he said his first
word.
Which
is eternity.
Eternity. And he does say some first words aren't funny, and I think he thought they were going to be. And then people were like, a couple of people I could hear were giggling because it was so awkward. But by 2 minutes in, it was just complete silence. And I go to Jay, and I'm like, did you know who this guy was? He was like, no. So then I go to the P-Track, did you know who this guy was? He was like, no, man, I didn't. He was just in the green room when I got there. So then I'm like, Jason, do you know this guy? He was like, no, man, I thought Jay brought him. And I was like, holy shit. So I go to Megan, I said, Megan, did you approve this guy to do a guest set? She was like, I don't know who he is. So I go back instantly and start lighting him, right? He does, I think only did 6 minutes.
Oh, this is all happening while he's on stage.
Happening like within the first 2 minutes he's on stage. And he wraps up, you know, pretty quickly. But it was one of those things where he comes off stage and then he goes and he sits down with his people right away. We're all back there. The V-Track goes up, takes him out of a 25-minute set, probably takes him 10 minutes to get the crowd going again. And even then, they were kind of like, I don't know.
It's basically rebooting the show.
It's rebooting the whole show, and in a way, it was almost kind of like we chopped their leg out, that we were only going to get, you know, a hobble from the audience at this point. If he had, if that kid had not been on the show, I have no doubt we could have burned the place down. But he literally, like, sprayed water on everything, and we're trying to get a fire going. And I saw some people that definitely, like, didn't seem impressed from the beginning, really lose their shit when the headliner came on stage. So to me, it's like, as long as you lose your shit at some point in the night, you got your money's worth, as far as I'm concerned. But it was also that thing when I got back after the stage, Megan was like, all right, I got to go. Where is he? And I pointed him out, sitting there, and she was like, yeah, who told you you could be on the show? And he was like, Megan Knight. And she was like, I've never seen you before. And he was like, I'll tell you after the show. She's like, I kind of need you to tell me right now. I'm the manager here, and that was not approved. So apparently, he thought it was supposed to be an open mic night, and it had he had contacted the club 2 months ago. Someone from the box office told him it was an open mic. He needed to bring five people, and he'd be able to go on, and this, that, and the other. Well, if he had told me back there, like if I'd been like, what are you doing here? He's like, I'm here for open mic. I'd be like, it's not open mic night.
Right.
You know, if he had showed me an email or whatever and said, I have five people out there, then I would have been like, well, you're doing a guest set then. Sight unseen, I would have just said that. You know, if you bring five people to a show I'm producing, chances are I'm going to give you a guest set. You know what I mean? Just not that hard to think about it. And but if I had known he was that unfunny, I would have been like, sorry, bro. We're going to have you come back on a real open mic night, and I'll make sure you get on or whatever.
Wow.
But it was just untested. He said he'd been doing comedy for a year. And it, if he had, it was like, seemed like it was like his first open mic was a year ago, and this was his second one.
Okay, wow.
But I've seen guys be 10 times funnier on their first set than this guy was, however many times he's done it. But that being said, Sunday night, paid show, coming behind all, you know, coming behind a professional or whatever, that's not going to be the easiest spot to follow. Open mic crowds are sometimes a little more forgiving.
A little more forgiving, yeah.
What's it like doing magic and comedy? What was it like for you starting out doing magic and comedy in like a heavy comedy thing? You know what I mean? Like, I imagine being a magician where you are the draw yourself, or like I'm putting on a show and people come, they're expecting to see magic. That their expectation level is different than when people are just doing jokes and probably not even that very good at their jokes yet, and then you come up and you've got these magic tricks and jokes. Like, I remember thinking, like, it was, I was like, this guy's cheating. This guy, this guy's on PEDs or something. What was the experience like for you personally, and then, like, from the community?
Well, I mean, it was received two different ways. Different people perceived it different ways. There were some people that are all about it, and then you have some people that are just such die hard, just stand up. It's a person in a microphone, and that's it. And all you need to be funny. And then there are some other people that are more accepting of I would say variety comedy,
right.
Which, you know, I'm grouping in anyone like a guitar comic
sure.
or a ventriloquist
sure.
or a hypnotist or anything like that. It's like, so my kind of my viewpoint on it would be that funny's funny no matter how you get that laugh.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
like
yeah.
if you're, you know, if you're getting pretty much about the same laughs per minute that a stand-up is getting or more.
Right.
I mean, I feel like that at the end
doesn't
of the,
matter what you're feeling.
It doesn't
with.
Matter what yeah. what is there. If you're getting, because I feel like it should be entertaining, not.
That's what I was going to say. I think that that's more so than funny. Were you entertained?
Right. And the thing is like the magic. I don't really go into it like, hey, I'm going to fool people.
Yeah.
I want to. I would rather someone walk away and say, "Boy, that guy was funny." Or, wow, that was really entertaining, rather than, wow, how did he do that?
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's cool if they, you know, if I can fool them also, but that is not my...
Right.
That's not what I'm trying to do. I'd rather them be entertained and have, you know, laughed and had a good time as opposed
sure.
to...
Sure, and I think that's what I always thought about you, is that it looked like you were having fun with it. You know what
yeah.
I mean? Which is something different than I see some... And they're probably, like, way more like the Amazing Jonathan or whatever, who his whole kind of... Part of his shtick is that, like... He's not that into it. Or,
right.
Or, you know what
yeah,
I mean? Or, like,
he's
kind of tired of it or whatever. Like,
yeah.
And I thought that was a really neat aspect for you. Now, you've never done anything but be an entertainer professionally.
No. I mean, there was a short stint where I sold men's suits, and the whole reason was so I could get a discount on suits to wear for shows.
Wow, that sounds like something I would do.
So, like, I worked for S&K Menswear, and you had to work there 3 months to get the 50% discount. So I worked there for 4 months. I bought 4 suits and I left.
So you did you like tell anybody your secret plan the whole time?
No. Well, I mean,
did you think like while you were doing it, like maybe I will stay on?
I mean, well, I it turned out I was really good at it.
Yeah.
I was actually, I only did it part time. And just because I'd worn suits for so long, I was 18, 19
yeah.
when I did this. So it was, you know, I'd worn suits for shows and that kind of thing. So I just naturally I knew how to pair them together and that kind of thing. And it was just pretty easy to upsell people, because someone comes in to buy a suit, especially it's normally for a funeral or a wedding
right,
and
right.
they need it
quickly.
Yeah. They need it now. So it's not really, you know,
I'll try these on. Yeah. I'll let you know what I think. Yeah. It's
right.
usually like,
yeah,
I
it's like, all right, do it because,
job.
You know, cause we got to do alterations or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah,
it's,
yeah.
you know, that's going to take a day.
What's the average price of a suit you would sell?
Well,
back
I
then.
Mean, they had everything. Like, they had something that was, like, the brand was Kilbourne and Finch, and you could get 2 suits for $199.
Damn.
Now, that's not ties and shirts and all
right.
that, but that's jacket and pants. So they had that, but then they also had suits that were $600 for...
What's the biggest difference?
Suit.
Thread count? Thread stitching? What is it?
That's... Just the fabric it's made yeah. of. Like, the Kilbourne and Finch were all the shiny.
Yeah.
You know, like... But,
shark
you know,
skin
they, yeah, like, all looked real, like, you know, real... polyester.
Yeah, yeah, Kim Jong Il sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was all those kind of things. But.
That's crazy. I never owned a suit until comedy. And even still, like, the idea of, like, a suit. Like, I have them, but I'd never wear the suit. I always wear, like...
Sport coat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I wear it as a sport coat.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Jeans. Now, I have worn my suit to people that are like, damn, that's a nice suit. And I'm like, it's jeans.
Yeah.
Yeah, these are jeans. And they're like, oh, I didn't even notice. And that's kind of the point of it. But it's funny. Like, I bought my first 2 suits and a tuxedo, all like kind of like in the first 6 months that I started performing at Funny Bones.
Okay.
Like, just like, I think I was like my first MC week or whatever. And I went back and looked at some YouTube video. I'm wearing a gray suit on stage. And it doesn't look bad. But it looks horrible compared to, like, where I am today.
Right.
It was almost like the suit upstaged my comedy.
Okay.
But in a way, I think it also gave me some latitude because I was getting some good laughs. But the way I was wearing the suit just didn't look right. I was heavier. And the suit was smaller. You know what I mean?
Okay.
And so it was one of those things where I was like, now I know how to wear a suit. And I usually choose not to. But... But I always think about that in terms of, like, I sold a bunch of suit jackets this summer because I had bought them all when I was like, well, I'm a suit comic.
Right.
And now I'm like, I'll wear a suit on New Year's or a special occasion, you know, like a holiday show or a corporate show or something like that. But other than that, I'm not comfortable in a suit.
But the jacket, you can toss the jacket on. It really
was just
yeah. You could, I mean, any.
That's a game changer.
Yeah,
really.
It really is.
That's a game changer.
You can wear that with a t-shirt and it looks,
that's
you know.
True.
I mean,
that's
it looks
true.
It looks good.
It looks intentional. And it also, like you said, even with a t-shirt, you can be better dressed casually than everybody else.
Right.
That's not wearing a jacket
right.
when you have one. It's almost like, oh, who's this guy?
Well, it's funny because, like, in the magic world, wearing jeans is like...
Shorts?
No, wearing jeans.
Oh, okay.
In the magic world, all the older magicians look down on that. So,
I'm
the young whippersnapper. And
right.
it's kind of funny because they're like, ah, can't you get a nice pair of, you know...
Slacks
or whatever, you know.
Trousers?
Like, yeah. And it's like... you know, so this is a guy. He's like, I saw you wear rhinestone suspenders, motherfucker. Like, seriously, you know. But you know, and then so I always thought it was funny that my defense is I got a pair of those Rock Revival jeans.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, these jeans cost more
as much as a suit.
Much as a whole suit.
Yeah.
Like, I got a $200 pair of jeans on. Really,
that was That was my next transgression, was into fancy jeans and stuff like that. Now. What I've devolved into is the lowest cost and the most basic look.
Yeah.
Black jeans, black shirt, black belt, maybe black shoes or burgundy shoes or something. So I like burgundy because it kind of throws it off a little bit. And plus, I wear dress shoes. So the only thing that separates me from the servers is my shoes.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Because you'll see a server, they'll be wearing like non-slip, almost tennis shoes, because I got to do a lot of laps in a kitchen or whatever. But when I work at the Funny Bones now, the only thing that separates me from the servers is I'm not wearing an apron and I have nicer shoes. But other than that, get my jeans, I get them at Amazon. But the theory was that I could get it anywhere. I could buy the, if I landed and my outfit wasn't in my suitcase, I could go to JCPenney and get it. I could go to Walmart and get it. And I have found now that I have a superstition, if I don't wear, you know, the black on black on black, then I just don't feel like myself.
Yeah.
Do you have a rhythm like that, or did you have a rhythm like that? Because you started as a younger, you know, you started younger than me. So, like, did you grow out of the suit and straight into it, or did you phase back and forth? Did you see a difference in the audience when you switched up?
Well, I mean, when I started working comedy venues, it was I kind of switched to wearing more what a stand-up comic wears, wearing, you know, jeans and a button-up, or wearing, you know, that kind of thing. And I always, before, it was more than, like, a suit. For certain acts that I did, I would have an actual costume that was for that act because, you know, it went along with a theme or, you know, whatever. Because I used to do magic competitions and that kind of thing. Because they're, you know, regional and national and even international level competitions.
Now, is that in front of an audience or in judges?
Both.
Okay.
You know, there are judges in an audience. You know, some of the regional ones, it's kind of anyone that wants to compete can go, and they register for the conference, and then they pay the entrance fee to the competition and do it. But then on the kind of the national and international levels, you have to submit a video, and because they only accept so many, kind of like we were talking about with the Clash.
Right.
It's not, you didn't have to bring people, but they're only 10 spots, and
they're gonna
pick
the best.
So there was one that I did that was in Vegas that you know, they received 74 videotapes, they accepted 12, and then those people, and you have to foot the bill to go to Vegas.
Everything. What was the prize?
It was a. $500 cash prize, and then there was a $500 like savings bond thing that went along with it too. So it didn't even begin to pay.
I mean,
you know,
cover the cost
of going. You know, because I mean, it's like
they probably made $15,000.
I was 17 at the time, so my mom and stepdad are traveling with me.
You
know, so that's three plane tickets, and you know, plus registering three people, and then the hotel and all this. But on the way there, though, it's like one of the craziest stories. That's ever happened is I used to do an act that I used big parrots.
Uh-huh.
So I had a blue and gold macaw and an umbrella cockatoo in my show, plus six doves.
Jesus.
So I'm flying with that, which is outrageously expensive too, because you have to get medical paperwork.
Right.
And paid the airline.
Do they? Do you have to like sedate the birds to fly?
You don't. But what I used, I had a custom made kennel that would go in the belly of the plane. They had a pressurized cabin that was made for animals to be down there. problem is, this was January that we're traveling, and it was too cold, and they don't allow them down there if it's below, I think, 20 degrees or something like that. And it's not going from, it's not while they're on the plane, but it's going from the airport across the tarmac onto you know. So, had to carry the birds on the plane. In kennels.
Holy shit.
So there was one kennel that we had to buy off for the airline because it wouldn't fit.
Yeah.
You know, the one that we had wouldn't fit. And so my blue and gold macaw decided to eat a hole in the side of this kennel that we bought from the airline. And when I go to check and I realize what she's done, she actually comes out of the hole and is now flying around inside of an airplane that's in...
Holy shit, yeah. Like 30,000 feet
30,000 feet
in the air.
Feet in the air.
Oh my
People
God.
Are freaking out. And this is one of those big planes where it's like, you know, it's like two seats and then four in the middle and then three on the other side.
Yeah,
and, you know,
yeah.
It's like a real wide plane. Right. This bird's circling around in there. Well, I held up my hand and she comes and she lands on my hand. Everyone's freaking out. I mean, they don't know what's going on. I mean,
is there a magician on the plane?
this is like a year or two after 9/11.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Oh,
this
yeah.
is like,
that bird's got anthrax.
Yeah. So this bird's flying around and then I catch it on my hand, and it takes the biggest shit ever right in the middle of the aisle.
Right.
A big, you
yeah.
know, you've seen bird shit on your
yeah,
windshield.
Yeah, yeah.
This is, you know, a huge amount. So I got black flagged by Delta Airlines for 2 years. Up until a couple of years ago, I still got that random security check where they pull you aside and my ticket was always stamped with something.
Oh, wow.
Like, I was in the system.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
it
yeah.
was anytime I bought a plane
bird
ticket.
Terrorism.
Was, yeah.
The, so did you keep the bird with you for the rest of the flight?
Well, I ended up, because the kennel wasn't, it wouldn't
it wasn't
contain
sound.
It.
Yeah.
You know, so I actually had to basically hold the bird in, standing in the back of the plane. And then when it got to the point where we had to land, I had to put it in the kennel and hold it.
Close to
it, you know,
body,
close
yeah.
to me, so it couldn't. The bird couldn't get out. So it was a crazy experience. And then, you know, we land and we get into the cab, and the bird goes, "Good girl, I'm a good girl." No, you are not.
The opposite of a good girl. Oh, that's crazy. What had the birds go away? What made you stop using the birds in the
It
air?
Got to the point to where I started. It was very difficult to travel with them. I mean, that was. Wasn't the only time that I traveled with them. There were many times. And like I said, I'd have to get vet paperwork, and it was only good for 14 days, so you have to renew it. I got really good at forging it.
Yeah.
You know, because it was
Let
ridiculous.
Let me see your bird papers.
Yeah. And it was, you know, it was like $150 every time I went and got paperwork. And it, like I said, it was only good for 14 days.
Yeah.
So sometimes if I was somewhere long enough, I'd have to get it again for the return. So that's where, hence the photoshopping.
Yeah. It's funny how these careers have us get better at different things.
Yeah, well, it reminds me, it's like Andy Dufresne. It's like,
yeah.
I had to come to prison to become a criminal.
Yeah, that's funny. What like the birds, like... what would you do with them? Like, what would they do in the act?
Pretty much opened the show with the cockatoo production. I did it several ways over the years. At one point, I had a feather and would wave the feather, and then the feather would turn into the bird.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, it's a big white
yeah,
bird.
Yeah,
it had
yeah.
the crest that went up
yeah,
and all that
yeah,
kind of
yeah.
stuff.
So very majestic looking.
And then I at the time I was doing a pirate themed act. It was very like early Pirates of the Caribbean was out.
Wow.
So I got booked a lot because of that.
How much have you been able to, like, how many times have you had a theme like that in your act?
You know, that's the only time yeah. that it was like that. And that was an act that I won a lot of awards with. The one in Vegas, I actually ended up winning contest. So that
nice.
Was a big, it was the Lance
So
Burton
it was
Award.
Worth it.
It was worth it, yeah. It was worth it.
Did you cash in that savings bond already?
Yeah. Years ago.
As soon as it matured. Yeah, that's basically the only savings bond I ever got. I cashed in as soon as it matured.
But the you know, the birds kind of just were getting too hard to travel with, and then...
Sell them, or did they die of natural causes?
No, they're still alive. I mean, I actually know where they are. Because these birds lived 65, 70 years.
Oh my gosh.
There's one in like New York City Zoo. There's a macaw that I think's over 100.
Wow.
You know, it's like a record. But
yeah.
So one of them I sold to a magician in Las Vegas. So you know,
it's still working.
So it's still still working. And then the other one I actually sold to a bird aviary, like a bird rescue place, you know? And then it was later sold to someone else. And it's funny because it ended up being someone I know. And it's like, well, if I would have known you were interested, we could have cut out the middleman on this
That's
deal.
Funny.
But yeah, so you know, and it's so it one the cockatoo's still in town and the macaw's in Vegas. And
do you ever see the birds over at the Wharf tobacco shop?
I've been in there before. Yeah,
I wonder if their life expectancy is shortened by the fact
all that smoke.
Yeah, because everyone smokes in there.
I would say it would have to be.
It seems like I'm surprised they're like, because they sound great.
Yeah,
but I wonder like if smoking has that same effect on a bird, like.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if their respiratory system works the same way or what. I mean, it may, because that is a big problem. I know people that have parrots that only live to be about 8 or so because of respiratory issues.
Really?
It's kind of common. I think it's something to do with the breeders.
Just like dogs or
anything.
Kennel dogs.
Yeah.
Oh, that's crazy. What do you have coming up on the comedy docket for 2017? Anything new and exciting?
I got my first feature week for Funny Bone.
Oh yeah, where at? Where
I'm
are you
doing
going?
Syracuse.
That's my favorite club.
Is it?
Well, it's my. I'll do like Greg Fitzsimmons. It's one of my top three favorite clubs.
Okay.
And it was one of the first ones I got to do on the road for Funny Bone. And it's a huge club. It's kind of in this style, but it's like the room is wider.
Okay.
It almost seems like it holds an extra 100 people than this
okay.
one. But Albany and Syracuse, fantastic experiences. I feel like they have the sensibility of what I'm looking for from an audience, which is diversity and not to be too one-sided in any direction.
Yeah.
It's in a giant mall, and same with Albany, and that helps. I think it's indoor access for both of them, so
okay.
that helps. And they just treat you great.
I have heard great things about the staff and management there, and just it's a...
That to me probably is the number one thing, regardless of how I feel about the weekend,
mm-hmm.
is how well the club is run.
Yeah.
There's one club that I went to this summer that every show started late, and it wasn't really management's fault, but the MCs at this club have a notorious, I don't want to say notorious. There's two MCs that I've heard at this club. One's preferred over the other one, but they both go over their time tremendously. And it's hard to say because, like, what the rules are for MCs at this club, they're not bound by every other club in the country.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like, that's not...
Well, I mean, I have noticed that some of the other ones, MCs don't do as many announcements as
true.
Dayton.
True.
I don't think.
I think that's... That's one of those things that gets passed down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so like John Craig was the first guy I knew personally to MC here. And so when he was telling me this is what they want me to do, we were all listening like, okay, so this is what I'll have to do when I get it, which was a sheet of announcements.
Right. It's very long.
Yeah. And
and your first time doing it, you get this and you're like, oh, gosh, this is.
I MC'd here a couple of weeks ago and it was the first time I'd been here all year. It was the first MC week I think I'd done all year. And I rolled into those announcements like I had been doing them every day for the last year. I just rolled in because I needed to kill a couple minutes because the show ended
mm-hmm.
while checks were still out.
Okay.
And so I just went into the announcements or whatever, and I was like, I can't believe I still remember this. But it was actually like more important than my jokes at the time.
Right.
You know? But that was the thing I was going to say about this other club is like no announcements, 20, 25 minutes up front, and then they're going to do time behind you too.
Wow.
And then they may or may not sell merch.
The MC.
Which is something like, you know, like here, 10, 15 minutes tops is the MC in a three-man show. You're never selling merch. And you're never doing time unless the headliner asks you to.
Right.
You know? And
the first time I ever saw an MC sell merch was the Atlantis, the Bahamas.
Yeah,
room.
Yeah.
And the MC, he's a house MC. He's been there like 14 years.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he sells shirts and same type of thing. He does like 25 minutes up front and then he'll do material in between the feature and headliner. It's kind of, it's a different thing, but it's his house, house gig and he's been doing it 14 years. What are they going to do? Stop
at
him now?
Point, at that point.
And that's probably, I'd venture to say those people have probably been...
I think that's part of it, and I think part of it is also just a lack of oversight, and also I think this club in particular is a little bit more urban, and I think the urban the urban model is a little bit different, which is basically, like I'd say in a more of a room, like an A affluent, mostly white room, the model is going to be, if anybody asks you to slow it up, hold off a little bit, then you are obliged to. Whereas in a urban room, no one's ever going to ask you to do that. And if you don't swing for the fences, that's on you. Mm-hmm. But I have seen comics, I would say more tame comics, come just short of asking the feature act to take it easy. Like, try not to whip them up so much. That's not what I do. So it's going to be hard for me to follow you if you whip them into a riot before.
Right.
And there's certain things where I'd be like, when I first was learning, I was like, well, you're basically asking him to be less funny.
Right.
But if the show isn't structured right, like if the show's like, you know, super urban MC, super white feature, super white headliner, then everyone's kind of suffering from whatever the MC does because he's setting the stage for what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. But when anybody does 25 minutes up front, it sets the stage. It makes the show, one, longer than it needs to be. Two, I feel like the reason it's 10 to 15, 20 to 30, 45 to an hour is because the first couple times I came to a club, I couldn't tell the MC was on stage for less time than the feature act. And I couldn't really tell that the feature act was on stage for less time than the headliner. They almost all seemed to do about the same amount of time, but it was just them ramping up to what was to come. You know what I mean? For attention span's sake.
Right.
Like the first guy takes you a little bit, the next guy you actually have a little bit more patience with, and then the third guy, it shouldn't matter. You know, the headliner should be good enough to take anybody out of the show.
But well, and that's how I kind of feel. If you're a feature that's burying headliners, maybe just happening one time is
could
be a fluke or just not a good pairing, like you were saying.
Yeah.
But if you're constantly doing that, maybe you shouldn't be featuring. Maybe it's time for, you know, for bookers to step you up. You know?
It is, and it's one of those things where I think you have to look at what is truly the nature of becoming a headliner, right? Because it's not always about being the funniest guy. It's about who puts the most butts in the seats.
Right.
So I've seen guys, I've worked with a couple celebrities, former celebrities, or maybe like they're just not at their peak now, but they put the butts in the seats, but everybody on the show was funnier than them.
Right.
You know what I mean? And it was one of those things where it's like, okay, so we'll call it so-and-so and friends, you know, instead of just this person's show. And that gave me like this insight. And then I saw this other thing when I was out of town where Doug Benson has Doug Loves Movies, which is like, it's like a show unto itself. It's just like a podcast and a show, and people come out. He sold out this Funny Bone in the middle of the day.
Really?
Yeah. And I mean, it wasn't sold out, but every tier was full.
Right.
And I was thinking, like, and he flew in from Los Angeles to do that. You know, came
just
in
that one show. It wasn't just an addition on to.
Came in on Friday, hung out all day Friday, all day Saturday, left on Sunday, and brought a guy with him. And the other people that came to do the show, there was only two local guys and including Doug, three people flew in to do the show. And I was like, if you can justify flying in to do a show from LA to Orlando, that's got to be a moneymaker. And then I thought, like, well, what would be, that's when I thought of you. And I was like, oh, man, David Stanley's got that lick where he can do a show in the middle of the day if the club is so inclined, if you're so inclined.
Right. And that's something, you know, is as far as featuring for Funny Bones, I mean, you know, Syracuse is, like I said, my first one, so we're not, you know, rocking the boat or anything doing that. But I feel like once I made my rounds and have been to each of the clubs once and they're familiar with me the next time through, if I could pitch doing a family-friendly matinee Saturday or Sunday, you know, I'm already there.
Exactly.
And there's dead time during the middle of the day. You know, why not, you know.
Put it on the calendar. Make your calls, whatever you do. And that's the other thing. It's like, I think about that too sometimes, and that's probably the best time because so you go through, you do it, they see what you do, they like you, whatever, and then when you get your booking the next time around, you reach out. What I do when I get the bookings is I reach out, I look at the calendar first, make sure that the headliner's there for every single night because sometimes you can pick up a headline on a Wednesday. Sometimes they just put you in there whether you ask for it or not.
Right.
But sometimes they won't put you in there if you don't ask for it or if they haven't seen you. But that's you know, you send that email, hey, I'm coming in a couple of weeks or whatever, or sometimes it's like a couple months.
Right.
And that would be the time to be like, look, I saw you don't have anything going on Saturday days. I don't know if you guys do that or not. But that to me is a beautiful thing, especially for a guy like you, because the opportunity to connect with younger people and their mm-hmm. parents at the same time.
Well, and then, you know, the other thing is, say we're doing it on Sunday, which is, I mean, Saturday or Sunday, I'm good with either day, but, you know, Saturday, it could be even be a 5 o'clock. That way, you know, I mean, it becomes a 3-show day for me.
Yeah.
But, you know,
it's. Now you're not bringing people in and sending them home or whatever, like the staff is
right,
already there.
Right. They're already there. So, that, you know, doing like a 5 o'clock. You know, now, that being said, that's kind of early for dinner. It's past lunch, so I don't know if what the club is, you know, that might affect them, and they would know that better than, you know, than I would. But the other thing is, you know, if we say we do it Sunday, that's 1 show Thursday, 2 Friday, 2 Saturday that I can promote it from stage.
Yeah.
Say, hey, or the MC can say, hey, you know, if you like that guy you just saw, come back on Sunday, 2 o'clock, bring your kids. It's a family-friendly show.
Could be completely, you know, different, even if all you do is change a few degrees.
Right, right. And, it, you know, and so it's definitely an angle that...
That's a beautiful
angle. I mean, why, you know, why not make that extra money? I mean...
It's, to me, it's one of those things, why not make the extra money, but making the club the extra money...
Right.
...is one of those things that has them want you to come back. More often, mm-hmm. and then it's like... The idea of going to a club when you're not even the nighttime performer, somehow, like when I saw Doug Benson doing that, I was like, I don't know what my thing is, but I got to get something like this going for myself. Whether it be doing podcasts or a game, me and Jay have been tossing around a couple ideas for games, but it's beautiful when you can kind of create your own idea for what your future is going to hold financially, mm-hmm. professionally, happiness-wise. I mean, I don't know that I'd be more happy performing during the day than I would be at night, but the idea that I'm creating it myself, I don't think I've ever been this happy since I was like a professional poker person. Not really a player, but I had my own club,
mm-hmm.
and we would do daytime games sometimes there, and sometimes we'd have such a good day that it's like, I don't even want to come back tonight, you know,
yeah.
but you stay because it's like, it's not about you, it's about the people that want to play. And I think I'm constantly trying to like evolve myself into having some sort of business sense mm-hmm. with this, because it's so easy to just be a performer and be like, oh, just point me to the stage.
It's where so many people fail is they can perform but don't know how to
send an email or put together a calendar or anything like that.
Right.
What was your big breakthrough when you first my first big break was when you and I and Chris Allen, we all won 2 and 3 for the Titans of the Clash.
Right, yeah.
We were the finalists, top 3 finishers in the year. So I had the Clash of the Comics every month, and then at the end of the year, all those winners come back and compete. We were the top 3 for that one. And that was my first big break, because I think after that, I got my first weekend here.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, to me, was kind of like, that was like my green light to go ahead and start asking for stuff. You know what I mean? Like I felt like I couldn't ask for anything if I hadn't earned anything or hadn't proven myself.
And mine was kind of the same way. Because by the time that happened, I think that I was already working the road for Comedy Zone.
Yeah.
So that was kind of what got my foot in the door with Funny Bone.
Uh-huh.
And then off of that, you know, I was able to get...
How did you get in with Comedy Zone? Did you get a referral or...
Comedy Zone, the first gig I ever booked was the Bahamas. It's
okay.
2 weeks at the Atlantis.
Yeah.
And they have a comedy club there, Joker's Wild. And they had a fallout, a headliner fallout. So I'd never worked for Comedy Zone before, but my buddy Roy Haber...
Yeah, I know Roy.
...was going through... He was passing through and Charlotte, where Comedy Zone's office, Heffron... Yeah. office is, and they said, you know, Roy, we'd really like to talk to you, but we just had a, you know, headliner fallout for 2 weeks in the Bahamas, and it's in 2 weeks, and we got to get this, you know, figured out. And Roy saw I had sent him my promo pack, like this, you know, it was like a DVD and a whole, you know, envelope and all that. It was still sitting unopened.
Oh God, the desk. How lucky is that shit?
And it's like on top or where Roy could see the return address and saw my name on it and everything. He was like, Roy's like, have you looked at this guy? And they were like, no, but we will right now. and they popped it in and watched my DVD, and they called me.
Boom.
And so I booked that. So yeah. It's the first thing I ever booked for them. So that was kind of my foot in the door with that, because that went really well.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I've worked for them. I probably do 15 weeks a year for them.
That's awesome. They're who I'm trying to get in with right now. In fact, I just did a Comedy Zone gig not too long ago, and I've been bad with the avails, because I feel like if I send you emails or whatever and I don't get anything back, I'm disincentivized to keep sending that email
right.
on a three-week basis or whatever. But I'm getting better at it, so I'd say I've been sending them avails like once a month for the last couple months. But and I don't have any like expectation, but I do have this feeling that like if I could pick them up for even just 8 weeks a year, I would be unapproachable mm-hmm. as far as my ego and my satisfaction level as far as how much I'm working. Because for me, it's not a matter of like how well am I doing, how funny am I. It's a matter of like staying gone as much as possible.
Right.
You know what I mean? That's really like the ultimate goal. If I'm gone a lot, then I know I'm growing. And it's almost like I met guys when I first started before I had anything. Like all I had was maybe like Funny Business. Mm-hmm. I think it was the first one I got in with. And then all my MC gigs throughout Ohio, which really spoiled me my first couple of years, because I would get 4 weeks a year here at least, plus mm-hmm. off nights, and 4 weeks in Toledo, and then like 2 weeks out of, maybe not even 2 weeks combined, but like a bunch of one-nighters out of Newport.
Okay, yeah.
And then a bunch of just like kind of had like local gigs or whatever that kind of really had me feeling like I had become a professional. And then I did this road gig with Isaac Witte, who's a professional unto himself. I mean, he's a road dog, 20-year veteran. And he was like listening to like how comics talk about the bookers they work for is like him listening the bookers he doesn't work for.
Oh,
like
really?
The top bookers you'd want to work for or whatever are place bridges he's burned so long ago mm-hmm. he can't even like doesn't even, but he's still a professional. And the week I worked with him, we got into it. We're both the kind of guy that doesn't keep our mouth shut, you know, like, oh, so what you're saying is, you know, like not right. confrontational, but we laughed really, like, I don't know if I've ever laughed that hard riding with somebody, and also kind of like blah, 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 with somebody. We went at it, which I like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't want to have to bite my tongue if I'm with somebody and mm-hmm. we can disagree and not be disagreeable. But the that whole week we were together driving through North Dakota, South Dakota, and then I drop him off on Sunday, and then on Monday I see him post on Facebook, I'll be on Conan tomorrow night. Never mentioned it once while we were together.
While you were together.
Yeah.
You think he just found out?
No.
Oh.
I think he knew the whole time. It just was one of those things where he was like, it was almost like bragging downhill.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It was kind of a valuable lesson, like, because he starts talking to us about like, oh, I'm doing Conan on Tuesday. Then suddenly, like, that's all I would have wanted to talk about
right.
for the rest of the trip.
Yeah, how'd that end up? How'd that come about? You know?
Yeah. Book's that! But even that, like, and it wasn't even his first time doing it or any of that stuff. He's been on Letterman before and stuff. He's done a lot of real
right.
shit. And I just thought, like, oh, that's kind of an exercise in humility. And I remember thinking, like, also him being slightly proud of all the bookers I was trying to get in with, that he had already burned those bridges.
Right.
And I thought, you can be a professional comic and not work for any of the bookers I only know about. You know what I mean? Like, those were literally the only bookers I knew about. And he's making, you know, he showed me his bank account statement at one time. And it was like, it's a couple $1,000s in his checking account or whatever. We're like standing by the ATM or whatever. It's like, check that out. I looked over, I was like, damn. And he's like, yeah. And I was like, that's pretty impressive for a fucking road cut.
For
but
a road
like,
tank, yeah.
But like this summer, dude, I hit like the numbers. I mean, like I used to be a professional drug dealer, you know, professional poker player / club owner. And I didn't have that much money in my account as I did like selling merch and cashing checks.
Man, merch is where it's at. It's, on the road, it's the only way.
I don't know how anybody doesn't do it. I remember guys would come through here from LA, and I'm like, why do you not have a DVD or something that you could at least...
Well, it just kind of makes you wonder, did they just negotiate that much that it just, they don't even
maybe,
need...
but I don't think so, because as far as I'm concerned, you could tell me, you can wink at me if I'm wrong, but I don't think features negotiate.
oh, this was a feature. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like a headliner, sure.
Well, the only exception would be is if a feature was brought by a headliner.
Sure.
A lot of times they're getting paid out.
That's a different deal. That's part of the door deal.
And, you know, sometimes I've heard of the headliner doesn't even merch, but they pay the feature not to merch because they don't like people to merch. And they were like, well, how much would you make merching? You know, I'd make about $200. Well, here's $200 to not merch this week.
Titus has been known to do that.
Yeah.
But I was working.
But he merches, though, right?
He merches.
Okay.
But
it's to eliminate competition.
It's to eliminate competition. I think mostly it's something different. I think it's something different. And I think that you would have a hard time getting them to admit this to you. But I think for most people, what it is, except for this guy, Benji Brown, who was a similar situation to what you just described, which was, I'm not merching, you're not merching. And I was, excuse me? Like, if you're not selling, why? It was a matter of if I sell. He's like, it's just part of my deal. I was like, okay. You know, and yeah. To me, it was like, I could get upset. But if he was like, I'm selling, so you can't sell, then I would have been like, okay, no problem. I wouldn't have even had an afterthought to be upset about it.
Right.
I would have been like, that sucks, I brought all this stuff with me. But I would, you know, I knew that was going to happen eventually. But it never crossed my mind that somebody would say, I'm not selling, so you can't sell.
Right.
But I think what it is with a guy like Titus or a guy like, say, Fitzsimmons, who's another guy who doesn't let people sell, is, and I love these guys, and I'm not trying to tell them what they think, but I just have a sneaky suspicion that what's really at the core of it is, I don't want you peddling your wares on my people.
Because they came to see that person. That's
yeah,
the headliner.
When you bring your... It would be one thing if the room was papered.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And we both came here not knowing what we were going to get. But
if they sold out on name recognition.
If they sold the tickets at all on name recognition, if they sold half the room on name recognition, then I kind of do get that. I personally, I think it's kind of an older school mentality, and I don't think it's insecurity. I just think it's an older school mentality of basically like, I respect my audience, and I don't want them to feel like they're getting hassled.
A sales pitch.
Yeah, a sales pitch from every comic in the room or whatever. And
and you know, some comics do take it too far, too. I've worked with headliners that they basically set up a flea market.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's like they'll have 11
items.
And it's like, that's ridiculous. I mean, it really, I pick one or two.
I have a hard enough time stocking my one t-shirt.
Mm-hmm.
I used to do it in two different colors. And then I found that whatever color I pitched from the stage was the color I sold after the show.
Okay.
Now, if I didn't take both colors up, you know, I never took both colors up, which maybe I should have. But if I took black up, they bought black. If I took gray up, they bought gray.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, well, this is stupid. I should just take one color. And then I had a hard enough time, like, keeping the sizes in two colors. And then it's like, then I got just went to one color, and I had a hard enough time keeping the sizes. Because, like, you get some nights at Tampa, I think I sold like $800 in t-shirts.
Wow.
And I wasn't even doing that good, dude. Like, I don't want to say it was my worst week ever, but it was like whenever I was in that building, I was nervous. And I don't know what it was. Almost like ghosts. It's an
really?
Old-ass building.
Okay.
It's a historic building. And like before
that's
I go on
stage. That's the one that has like a balcony.
Theater in the round. Yeah,
seen,
yeah, yeah.
I've seen like photos
like,
of it. And it's
like an antique version of Liberty or Columbus.
Okay.
But it's high.
Mm-hmm.
Like those balconies are way higher.
Yeah.
And it's a great room. But like Thursday and Sunday were like my only really two good nights. But I sold a ton of merch there, and it was super freaking hot. And you have to set up outside to sell on a first show.
Mm.
And I remember like I had to change my clothes because I was soaked through. I mean, like you could see sweat, cotton, like you know, it was like drying on my shirt, and it was all black. And it was just like one of those things. Where I was like, can't do this again.
I had the exact opposite of that at Snickers in Fort Wayne. We had to do it in the snow. So I'm out there freezing. And like you're trying to stop. You want to come over here?
Who am I making this out to? Just sign with your... No, just hold my hand and then sign it. Yeah. That square card reader, man. There was times when like I find this similar situation where like if I mentioned I could take credit cards, I'd sell all credit cards. If I didn't mention it, sometimes I wouldn't sell shit. But Syracuse and Orlando, I both like, and Syracuse, Orlando, Hartford, and Tampa were my best cities for selling merch this summer. And what made it so funny was after one of those weeks, I went over to Cocoa Beach and did a small room. Like, I was basically 2 weeks in Florida, mm-hmm. two different bookers, and I took my merch bag because I couldn't sell. This is the time I worked with the guy who was like, if I'm not selling, you're not selling. So I had a full bag, and I take it to the next show, and there's like 50, 60 people. I mean, the room's full, but it's only like 50 or 60 people. Mm-hmm. And like the other comics are looking at me in my bag like, ego much? You know, like, yeah. like there's probably only 60 shirts in the bag, but still, it's like, I don't want to unpack this bag and then pack some of it into a smaller bag,
right.
which I ended up having to do because it was like, I think I sold like 3 shirts that weekend or whatever. And I was like, I'm not carrying this bag around anymore. But it was...
And the thing with shirts is it about like every time you think you have it figured out the sizes to buy, it just totally goes away. It's like, oh, I sold a lot of XLs, so I'll order more XLs next time, and then everyone wants extra small the next.
Exactly. The only time I haven't, the only problem I've never had is 4XL. I've never had like an abundance of them, and I've never had a hard time. Like I probably have 4XLs from last year or from right. early in the year because like I would buy 2 with every order or whatever, and I'd probably only sell 1 every couple months. Right. And then I had one where I had a guy buy 4 of them at one time, and I was out of them then, you know, for the rest of the right. summer, damn near. So I bought 4 the next time, haven't sold one since.
Right.
And
but at the time you don't take those with you, someone's going to ask for it.
Of course. it never fails. And it's a tricky thing because you can get into a situation, and I've seen other guys get this way, where if your merch sales aren't up, you're not up. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You could have killer shows, you get all the money and save money on other things or whatever, but like you don't sell any shirts after the show and now you feel like you failed.
Right.
And I've had shows where like for the weekend I only sold like $200 or $300 worth of merch and I'm like, I don't know if I ever want to come back here again. And I'm thinking to myself like, you just got double what you got last year for, you know, right. and you're working out of town in a new club that you've never been to. I mean, it's like the way comedy works, you know, you MC, makes half what the feature makes, and the feature makes half what the lowest paid headliner makes.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, like, how greedy are you about this? Because it's really not about the money at the end of the day. It's just about being able to afford the lifestyle I've grown accustomed to.
Right. It's not like, oh, man, I sold a lot of merch. I'm going to go – now I have money to go party on. It's like now that's like – that covered my travel.
Yeah, yeah, here. Exactly.
And now the check that I get on Sunday is – you know, that's my money now. Like, that's the what I earned.
It's always, like, at this point, there's no, like, really putting it in the bank for me. I mean, it goes in the bank temporarily, but the thing I realized really quickly this summer was I had made some plans to pay off my car, and it was kind of contingent around, like, the last month of gigs.
Right.
And the last month of gigs, not even the last month of gigs, but the last full month. I stayed busy, so busy this summer, it was... different than every other year that I've been in comedy in that, like, usually it's, like, the winter's the busy time, and the right. summertime's just kind of, like, stringing it together. But this year I was, like, so busy, and then I was like, all right, in August I'll use the rest of the money I make in August to just pay off the car. I basically broke even in August because I didn't sell any T-shirts. Mm. You know, and it was one of those things where I just got so used to, like, oh, this is just, you know, I'm just good at selling T-shirts, I guess, or whatever, and it just yeah. turned out I couldn't sell at the one place, and then the next place was too small. And then just didn't work out the other gigs. And I remember feeling like, okay, at least you have enough money in the bank to, like, cover what you did. Because if I had gone hog wild and I was going to buy a new car mm-hmm. and all this, like, I would have
been feeling... A new Prius is hot, man.
It's super hot. For those that don't know, Matthew David Stanley is also a Prius owner and married and straight. So, yeah. Breaking the
law. So, yeah. I got that going for me.
You got that going for me.
You ever notice that, when you're test driving a car, do you test the horn?
Yes.
Okay, you do. Because see, the thing is, that was the biggest thing with the Prius for me is I didn't test the horn, and the first time I needed it, some asshole cut me off, and then I'm like, and it's like, you know, I was hoping for, you know, yeah, yeah. So I'm thinking of having it switched.
Yeah,
you know,
that's you what go. I'm saying. I saw a guy that did that.
Switched out the horn on the Prius.
You ever get on Prius chat?
Uh-huh.
It's, they got all kinds of modifications. So what I did this summer was, with some of my money, was I updated my Prius, not necessarily to like a 2015, but just got all the stuff that I installed a rear view camera, I installed a dash cam, I got a Android head unit, you know what I mean? Okay. Like I just kind of disabled all the beeps and stuff like that, and just went through and kind of did all the stuff. I got a remote start.
Okay.
And just kind of upgraded it to the point where I was like, I want to get another year out of this car at least.
How many miles are on it right now?
220.
Yeah.
So it's like,
you get another year.
Yeah, if I can get to 300, yeah. I won't feel like I went under. I didn't go underwater.
You have to take it to 300. I talked to Ray Price. He was an early Prius owner.
Yeah.
And he said his got to 300,000, and then the odometer reset to zero. I'm sure that they fixed that by now. But I'm thinking to myself, man, go drive that thing for 500 miles and then sell a 12-year-old Prius with 500 miles on it, man.
My dad sold his Volvo with 300,000 miles on it. He was like, I was like, when did the odometer break? And he was like, 12 years ago.
12 years ago.
I was like, Jesus Christ. He was like, I drove it back and forth from California about 6 times. And I was like, yeah, I was like, how many miles do you think are on it? He was like, probably 8. I mean, it was literally like a 1980 Volvo DLC or whatever it was. And then like the box car shape.
Right.
But it was in mint condition. And I was living in Hawaii with him in 1999. And we traded it and got some money back on a Honda Civic, like a 1990 Honda Civic four-door. Okay. And then he went back a couple days later because the clutch went out on my car, but it turns out it didn't go out. It was like, it was like a rope that holds the spring.
Oh, yeah.
The clutch. Well, that knot in the rope came untied.
Oh.
So somebody just had to go, it's a really easy fix. They charged me $20 for it. But at the time, I didn't know because the car was in the shop from like Friday night till Monday morning. And then he went back there to be like, hey, da, 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 da. But he was like, but nobody was there. And I also noticed that the Volvo was gone.
Oh.
So, like, they bought it and sold it the same day. And I was like, wow, now that's the fucking flip. But I remember it being in mint condition, and it had so many miles on it. I've never had, like, my Prius now, I keep it pretty fucking clean. But the outside of it, I've been in 2 accidents in Chicago where people didn't want to call the cops or anything. So I had no incentive to, like, call my insurance and take a hit. And they're just minor flesh wounds is what I would call them, but it's very Mad Maxy on the outside right now. It's looking.
You need some of that like diamond plate stuff that like molds around that. Yeah. It's like the peel off back and sticks on there.
I don't there's like yellow cab paint on the bumper. And,
nice.
One time I was at the Hookah Lounge.
It looks like a battle bot.
It does a little bit. It does
with
a
the wedge
bit.
Front end.
Dude, I was cleaning it and taking even though like I updated like I got like a dash cover for it and everything, and I was taking pictures of it when I was in Albany. No, I think actually I was in Syracuse, and I was in the parking lot because it was a giant mall or whatever. I was like, I'm going to take some pictures for Prius chat and everything. And I was looking at all the scars, and I was like, I kind of like them like that. it kind of keeps me honest because I remember when the accidents happened, that my thought wasn't like, damn, now my car looks used. It was more like, am I going to be able to fix this myself? Because one guy knocked my side view mirror off. A cab driver knocked my side view mirror off. And then this guy comes up out of nowhere, and he's like, you had a couple drinks? You had a couple drinks tonight? I saw everything. It was your fault and this, that. And I was like, am I getting set up?
It felt
like just weird. But then the guy that was like acting like he was going to set me up went and got my side view mirror, set it on top of my car, and then just ran off. He was clearly on meth or something like that and like dirty. But the cab driver.
But he saw the whole thing.
He said he saw the whole thing. And really what it was like in Chicago, there's no sleeping. There's no, if you're going to turn left.
Especially on
meth. Turn left. Yeah.
There's
exactly.
Sleeping, especially.
But I was like, I was getting ready to turn down a street, but I was like, I couldn't see if there was any parking on that street. Otherwise, I was going to keep going straight. So I was like, look, there wasn't anybody there. So I was going to keep going straight. And as I started to go straight, a cab was just like going around me, and so I pulled out a little bit, and then he hit my side view mirror and hit part of my front bumper, and then wasn't going to stop. And I was like, well, we should at least stop and make sure my car fucking works. And and then I was like, all right, I'm cool, whatever. And then a guy comes up when I was basically like, well, we can exchange information, but I'm not calling my insurance, I'm not calling the cops or whatever. And this guy was like, oh, he's definitely going to call the cops. Look at his car, it's a nice car, he's going to call the cops. And I was like, you know what? Fucking know me. And I was like, this car has 180,000 miles on it. I was like, I'm not that interested calling the cops. And
then you found out the mirror is $3,000.
The mirror was $50.
Okay.
And I was able to use the cover because I got a black mirror from eBay or whatever, and my car's gray. And so showed up, I was like, oh, that's going to suck. And then I was like, oh, I can just pop this off. And I popped the other one off, put it on. And now,
because it's just like a shell around it?
Just a shell around the outside. So it's like you could order the piece without the cover on it. Mm-hmm. I just didn't know that the cover came off so easy until I started like putting it on. But I installed it all myself. It was super easy. I mean, with the internet nowadays, I installed all my head deck and my reverse camera, which was the hardest thing. Was the reverse camera because I had to wire a relay.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Off my brake light. I had to like tap
off
my brake.
Off your backup light, your reverse light.
Exactly.
The thing that gets me with the Prius is you take it in for an oil change, and when they tell you that your cabin air filter needs replaced, and they'll come out and they do that little, they have it in their hand.
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, this is going to be $75. It's, what filters the air that comes into the cabin of the car. It's like, well, I get it. I know it is, but why is it $75? Well, we have to kind of take apart the dash to get to it. It's a lot of labor to get to it, so that's why we have to charge that. I'm like, well, you're holding the thing in your hand right now. It's like you had to do the labor to check it. Like, I guess just put it back.
Yeah, tap it out real quick.
Yeah, it's like what? So thanks to the YouTube, I was able to go on and I found out that it's just behind the glove box and it's a couple of little things. It was $8 at AutoZone.
I put
it in, they want $75 to do this because the labor is what gets you.
That's just one of those things where it's like, we're going to eat steak on Friday, so we're going to charge you $75. And I'm not mad at them. Where do you go to get your oil changed?
I do the dealership just because.
How many miles do you have on yours now?
I think I got like 42.
Okay, so you just got past the.
Yeah.
Like I did, I think I did the first 30,000 miles at the dealership, and then after that.
In the beginning, I did it because for buying the car, they gave me the first 2 years of recommended service.
Yeah.
Like whatever Toyota recommends that you do for the first 2 years, they did all that. Mm-hmm. So
that's what kind of like.
But I just had to put new tires on it. That's the first, so it's that kind of gives you an idea.
Yeah.
I just, my factory tires are, just.
Yeah, wow. I think I got mine around 40,000 too. In fact, I get new tires every year. I'm about to get new tires this month, I think. I look like I could go a little bit longer, but I'm going out west this winter, and there's just no point in fucking around. But I went to the dealership, and then I went to the dealership like maybe two more times after my maintenance thing had expired, and I was actually going to have to pay for the oil changes. And they're like, we're going to charge like $100 for the oil change and maintenance. He was like, you can go other places and get it for cheaper. It may not be a lot cheaper, but might be closer to your house or whatever. And I was like, oh, okay, I'll research. And I started going to Grismer, which was right around the corner from my house when I lived in Fairborn. Mm-hmm. And that was $80. And then I went to Walmart, $50. Mm-hmm. But I just hate Walmart.
Yeah.
The whole experience of like dealing with their auto is just depressing.
Yeah.
Midas, $50. Nice. And they do everything perfectly, and Midas is just a great company. It's just a great company for anything you have to deal with as far as mufflers, basic repairs, or whatever. I went to the one here.
You're
on
just saying
Fairway.
That because they sponsor your podcast.
I wish they would. I call them an unofficial sponsor. I call them an unofficial sponsor because I started going to the one in Airway when I used to deliver pizzas back in the 90s. And one time I needed repairs just to get to work. Like I had to get an alternator, and the guy was like, it was about $420 or whatever. I was like, I got $375 on me. You know what I mean? I was like, I can give you the rest of the money tomorrow after I work tonight. And he's like, we'd do the whole thing for $350, man. I don't want to leave you broke. He's like, that's kind of cutting out anything I'll make on it or whatever. I'll do the whole thing for
$350. Nice.
If you pay cash. And I was like, fuck yeah.
Yeah.
And so I remembered that guy. And so I went back, goddamn 20 years later, 25 years later or whatever it seems like. And the guy's still working there.
Oh, nice.
And I got my first two oil changes in my Prius there, and now the guy doesn't work there anymore. Probably retired or whatever.
Yeah.
But I told him when I was there about that experience. They called me, and I told them, they're like, how was your visit to Midas or whatever? And I told them, I was like, listen, I don't usually tell telemarketers this much information, but this is how awesome this guy was back then. And then I went back, and he's still there, and I just feel like I'm going to be a customer for life now. And I've gone to different Midases. I went to the one by the Dayton Mall, got the call, how was your service to Midas. So when I go to a different one, I always get a call from their service center asking how it was. And to me, it's like, that's how you
And they've consistently been good. All the different
I've
locations.
I've never had a problem. The one I go to now in Columbus is so, it's almost ritzy.
Okay.
It's in a nice area, and it's just like the one on Airway, it's not dirty, but it's an old building and an old shopping center or whatever. But they do a great job, very professional. And then I went to the one by the Dayton Mall, which is kind of a similar situation, but very professional. And then, but this one that I go to in Columbus, man, I think they charge me an extra five. I think it's 55 instead of 50. But they got like 20 bays.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. They get, me in and out. And they just
Do you do every 5,000 miles?
I do it every 10,000 miles. I get an oil change, but I get my I rotate my tires every 5,000 miles.
That's the same thing I do. Yeah, 10,000 on the oil and then 5 on the...
That's the only way you can keep those tires going. And I drive so much. I think I drive 50,000 a year.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and that's this year will be like one of the least because I flew to some gigs that I normally would have driven to. And what's your thoughts on flying like now?
I mean, the thing is it's kind of changed over the years because it used to be I would fly at shorter distances. But with the Prius now, the money savings from, you know, I can do that. So kind of the 8 to 10 hour mark would be kind of where I would start to consider.
Yeah, you know, when you're going to fly or drive.
When I'm going to fly or drive. Now, there are other factors. It's like, for instance, like a funny bone, you're working 4 days. So it's like you get there. Do I really want to be, I want to be in Omaha, Nebraska without a car for 4 days?
Yeah.
You make that call. Do I really want to have to rely on a busser from the club to come pick me up or a bartender or something or the manager or something?
That probably more than anything is what weighs on my decision. And
so if the club's within walking distance or something like that, that would be a different, you know, factor in. So if it's a longer time, but if it's like, you know, for a corporate gig, I mean, I'll fly to Knoxville, Tennessee. You know, like a 5 hour drive, but you know, they're paying for it. It's not coming out of my pocket. So
that's one thing I never thought of is putting that on the corporate gigs. I've only done a few of them. I mean, a good handful. I'd say I do a couple of them a year, but I've never thought of adding travel.
Right.
I always put it like on one line.
Well, generally I'll ask them, I'll say, would you like my all-inclusive fee or would you like my fee for the show and then break down,
because they might have a better deal on some of that stuff.
Well, because a lot of times they'll have corporate accounts with hotels and airlines and that kind of thing. So it's like, no, we'll just take care of it, you know, and we'll pay you your fee and then we'll take care of the travel expense and that kind of thing. So that, but then sometimes they're like, no, we don't want to have to worry about any of that. You tell us what you need to be here.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and then we'll, you know, and then you handle it. You handle it. Yeah. So it's
I could see some companies that wouldn't want to fucking deal with that, and other companies that'd be like, why would we let you deal with it? You know, that's just gonna make our.
The thing is, you know, a lot of times they can get those, you know, hotel points, and they can get those airline miles to their corporate account, which
is like if I was a booker,
or maybe they're paying for it with that. You know, maybe they're not even paying cash for it; they're paying for it with reward points.
I had when I worked in construction so many moons ago, they would fly us home every 2 months. If you were working far enough away, they would fly you home every 2 months for a week, and. And I remember each time I ever got to do it, I always got to fly first class.
Nice.
And that was the first time I ever flew first class. But it was just because they had the points and the auto upgrade set up for everything, because they were doing this for hundreds of employees. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, like, I'll always work for this company. I'll always be in construction because of this.
Because of this.
But it was not meant to be. Construction was not. Which probably led me to comedy in some way, shape, or form. But I remember working in construction thinking, this is a lot like being a comic. I'm in a different city all the time. I get to travel a lot. You know, I make good money and doing what I love. Get to go out drinking all the time.
Yeah.
And then I was talking to a project manager who was from Purdue. He just graduated from Purdue. One of the smartest guys I ever met in my life. And I was like, why do you work here? You know, it seems like you should be doing something a little more important than construction. He was like, well, sure, I'd love to just sit around and have people pay me to think shit up, but those jobs just don't exist. And I was like, what comics do.
Or do they?
Yeah, that's what comics do. And it was the first kernel of thought that I could do that. Because I was like, yeah, that sounds like a sweet gig. Who does that?
Yeah.
And he was kind of trying to lead me to believe nobody. But I've met up with him one time since I started doing comedy. And we were best friends when we lived in Mississippi because we would always make each other laugh. You know, he was kind of like a comic. Mm-hmm. We'd do like a Saturday Night Live, you know, just different things we'd recall or whatever. But now he's like super successful part owner of a construction company.
Nice.
And has family and kids and stuff like that. And I look at like all these people that I knew from my career type jobs or whatever that are living like a real life and existence and stuff. And I think like, I got so lucky to get out when I did. Whereas you never really went in except for like that 4 month stint that you did for ulterior motives the idea that you knew at that age that I'm going to pull this hustle on these people for my real shit that I want to do. Like, I always wonder, like, what it's like when you know what you want to do at such a young age.
You know, the thing is it's actually really, I just thought about this, is I never actually quit that job. I just, the manager just stopped scheduling me. So actually, about 6 years after that happened, I got, when S&K went out of business, I got a shareholder's check for like $86. It wasn't a lot, but I got this like shareholder's check because I was technically still an employee like 6 years later.
That's funny.
It was funny. So I never, I was actually still, I don't know, I would still be technically probably an employee that hasn't been scheduled in 11 years.
Imagine if it hadn't gone out of business for 20 or 30 years and you an $800 check. Well, holy shit. Stock market do work. Well, let's wrap this up. What do you got coming up date-wise? For we're doing New Year's Eve together.
We are. We're doing New Year's Eve.
At the State Theater in London, Ohio. Have you ever done that show before?
I have not. Haven't you?
I feel kind of guilty in that I'm the reason we're both there.
Okay.
I did the show a couple months ago, and it's like a small movie theater, but it's also a theater.
Okay.
And I was talking to the owners after my set. And they were like, oh, that was really funny. And I was like, yeah, you guys ever think about maybe doing this for New Year's? And they were like, oh, we did something like that once for New Year's where we had the kids come in early and we did a ball drop at like 8 o'clock, you know, so they could feel like it was the new year, whatever, but they got to go home early. And they said, you know, because nobody wants to really drive out of London. It's kind of a geographical oddity. It's like 30 minutes to everywhere. Mm-hmm. And nobody wants to be on the road on New Year's Eve that late or anything. And I thought, well, you know, that'd be great. Maybe we bring in a comedy show and, you know, you have like a magician and, you know, just some clean comics that people can come and enjoy it with their friends and family. You could do it early and then you could do a later show if you wanted for adults or whatever. They're like, well, we don't know if we have the population in the town for that. But that early idea sounds good. We'd love to talk about that. I was like, it's my idea or whatever. I was like, but clearly you have to talk to Dan Dean about this because he's the one that put me on the show. I would never try to do anything without him like that. And so I mentioned it to Dan as I was leaving. Oh, I talked to them about a New Year's Eve show or whatever. And then 2 days later, he's like, yeah, you're on the New Year's Eve show. We're going to do it. Me, you, Matthew, David Stanley. And I was like, yeah, I wasn't really thinking of myself to be on that show. I don't know that I got clean comedy for kids. But he was like, I think you'd be fine. And I was like, well, you know, I've been working on some stories. And I also would love to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And so I'm sitting here thinking to myself, like, you've always been jealous of Matthew David Stanley's ability to work during the day. And here's your opportunity to work with Matthew David Stanley during the day. Why wouldn't you seize it? You know? And so I'm happy for it. But I remember thinking it was just maybe 2 weeks ago that I fully embraced the idea of this being possible. And a part of it was doing that Ohio State gig that I did, which was in the middle of the day, which wasn't like squeaky. It wasn't child clean, but really it wasn't. It was completely clean, but it was like over kids' heads.
Right.
And that's what I'm trying to come up with, is something that's relatable to adults and children at the same time. I think I have a great story about growing up, you know, my first couple jobs. Spitting that into the funny is going to be the hard part or whatever, but if it's entertaining, then I can live with myself. And then I'm coming in here to do the show, I think, that night.
New Year's Eve with Mike Malone?
Yep.
Okay.
And I just picked that up, hosting, which would be nice, but it's funny about working on New Year's is I did it the first couple of years I was in comedy, and I was so lonely.
Yeah.
So lonely, because I would be, like, in the middle of nowhere. People came out to see the show and then went home for the rest of the night. I'm just, like, in a shitty hotel somewhere. I'm like, what? Is this what it's about? So I took a couple years off of doing it. Then I went and did it again 2 years ago. Last year I was off. This will be the first time.
Doing it here is different. This is like family, though.
This is
here,
like family. So it's in like, town.
Yeah, you know, it's people you know. You're not just on the road somewhere with a bunch of people you don't know.
That's exactly right. Especially like on the road in a small town,
right?
Where there's like where you're the if. My thought was this, is like if any small town is bringing me in as the headliner or even as the feature act, that's got to be a really small town, at least from back then. And I got to headline a show a couple of years ago, and it was really fun. And I really did like a full hour, 10 minutes, you know, like carried the ball and then some, but then didn't sell anything afterwards and felt like shit. I feel like shit for pitching when I don't sell anything afterwards. Because I've taken my shirt up more times than I can count and don't even mention it.
Like, intentionally or you forgot?
Well, one time I was at Wisecrackers and just ripped the roof off like really hard. And I was like, I don't want to cheapen what I just did with a shirt pitch or whatever. But it was the dumbest thing I'd ever done because I could have sold so many shirts. Nobody else was selling. And that place, I've always sold pretty good with shirts. And man, I just remember thinking like, yeah, you can't do that again. In fact, when I got off stage, Ross was like, yeah, I didn't think you were done because you never pitched your shirt. And I was like, yeah, I didn't want to cheapen it with it. He's like, bro, you got to pitch the shirt when you crush that hard. He's like, you're going to sell. I was like, I think it was just chicken shit, you know, like, what if I do this well, pitch the shirt, and then it doesn't sell, and then it erases that whole idea. It was the first time Amanda had come with me in a long time to see me, and she was like, holy shit. You know, and I was like, well, that's not normal. You know, I don't normally do that well. But
you didn't play it off like, yeah, that's right.
That's what I fucking do. That's how I go down when you come to town.
You know what daddy do.
So I'm bringing home that $75 a show, like, bam. Yeah, I felt like an idiot for that one. You play there, right?
Wisecrackers in Maryville,
it's going away.
Yeah, that's what I heard. I didn't know for sure, but
I talked to the show manager, and she said they're tearing the hotel down, and everyone's going on unemployment. So
that's
a
bummer. Yeah. I love that because you stay right there in the hotel, and that they have that little Irish bar right there. It's just a cool little.
It's just a great. It's just great when you get to stay in the same.
There's a Portillo's across the street,
right across the street.
Like, oh, it's terrible and awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, there's so much right there. It was like 45 minutes outside of Chicago, and getting there from Ohio isn't even hard. Yeah, that was one of my first, I remember my first run was with Kenny Smith, and we pulled off on that exit to get gas. He was like, yeah, there's a fucking club right around here somewhere. Oh, yeah, right over there. And it seemed like every exit we got off on, he would be like, oh, yeah, there's a club right over there. And I was like, how many fucking clubs are there? They're like those weekend hotel clubs or whatever, which are fly-by-night.
Well, I think there was a time that every Radisson had a comedy room. Like, every Radisson in the country had a lounge that had a comedy show in it at one point. And there was, like, a booker that, I don't know who it was, but they had that contract, and it was just, and you know, Comedy Zone had the same thing with Holiday Inn. There was like maybe not every Holiday Inn, but like
if there was,
there were a lot of them. And I mean, I think there was a time they were booking like 10 or 12 at one time, and you could just literally do that circuit of those little, you know, Friday, Saturday, you know, and you stay right there in the hotel, and it's cool because you get off the elevator and walk and do the show, and you know,
not having to leave the building is something.
Yeah, especially when you're featuring, you know, go upstairs, make a drink while the headliner's on. You come, you know, it's like
sweet spot.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
That's
beautiful.
Great. Well, this has been a lot of fun, Matthew.
Yeah,
this will be
for
our
me.
Second episode of this week. So this one probably come out Thursday or Friday, and then I'll send you a copy of the link.
Sweet.
You can share it if you like. You are here.
Yeah.
You don't have to listen to it if you don't want to. But Matthew David Stanley, comedy magician. We'll be performing together at the London State Theater in Ohio on New Year's Eve. You can come check us out. I think the show starts at 5 o'clock. And where are you at? Where else are you at? You got shows the rest of this month? Where are you going?
I have corporate stuff. I'm in Knoxville, Tennessee this Thursday. Then Saturday I have another corporate in Versailles, Ohio.
Versailles!
Yeah.
So. Fucking making that big dollar, big jing-a-ling. All right, well, I thank you for being a guest of the show. And follow Matthew David Stanley on social networks. What's your handles?
At MDS Comedy Magic.
MDS Comedy Magic. I like the MDS because whenever people say, I'm doing a show, I'm like, yeah, who with? And they say MDS.
Yeah, it sounds like a disease.
It's like, I think it sounds like somebody who's trying to cure a disease.
Yeah, cure. Okay, yeah.
But it does roll off the tongue.
It does. No. I've debated just switching to that.
Oh, really?
And, well, because that's what, you know, most bookers or just people that know me, it's saying Matthew David Stanley's just long. So they say MDS.
What up, MDS? Knows,
and, you know, and people know who they're talking about, I guess.
No, it is. That's a great moniker, man. All right, thanks a lot, brother.
Yeah, thank you.
Bound wind, she whispers, it's okay, we'll